Canada is the world's leading mining nation.
60% of all public mining companies are listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange.
About half of all mining capital is raised in Canada.
Many Canadian mining companies have become notorious for damaging communities and the environment and fueling wars and repression all over the world.
They're displacing communities and killing people.
And they've left a legacy of mercury and lead contamination in that area that will never be cleaned up.
We use terms like genocide, ethnic cleansing.
We have a huge problem in terms of access to justice.
Just as European settlers created Canada by stealing and plundering native land, its mining companies today continue these practices all over the world.
This colonialism and neocolonialism is what Canada is all about.
You're listening to Path of Destruction, Canadian Mining Companies Around the World, a three-part radio documentary. I am Asad Ismi.
And I'm Kristen Schwartz. This is Fueling Wars and Repression, the second episode in our series. For the next half hour, we focus on how Canadian mining companies have been stoking conflict in the Congo, Guatemala, Canada, and on an international scale.
Canadian mining companies have fueled wars and been linked to repressive governments all over the world, including in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Sierra Leone, Tanzania, Guinea, Colombia, Burma, Chile, Indonesia, the Philippines, Guatemala, Mexico, Peru, Thailand, and Canada itself.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, is Africa's richest country in terms of mineral resources. A decade-long war in the Congo has killed more than 5 million people and displaced about 6 million. This genocidal war was started by the United States, which used its proxies Rwanda and Uganda to invade the DRC in 1998 in order to establish Western control over its resources.
Though a peace agreement was signed in 2002, the war continues in the eastern part of the country. In 2002, the United Nations Panel of Experts on the Illegal Exploitation of Natural Resources and Other Forms of Wealth of the Democratic Republic of the Congo released a report in which it accused 8 Canadian mining companies of pillaging the Congo and contributing to conflict there. The companies named were Banro Corporation, First Quantum Minerals, Kinross Gold, American Mineral Fields, International Panorama Resources, Tenke Mining, Melchior Resources, and Harambe Mining. In total, the panel named 125 companies and individuals for having contributed directly or indirectly to the Congo War.
Banro and Barrick Gold have held mining properties in eastern Congo under Rwandan or Ugandan control. According to Le Monde Diplomatique, both companies have been accused of, quote, funding military operations in exchange for lucrative contracts, unquote. Intelligence specialist Wayne Madsen, who has worked for the U.S. National Security Agency, testified to the U.S. Congress in 2001 that, quote, Barrick and tens of other mining companies are helping to stoke the flames of civil war in the DRC, unquote. Madsen explained that Barrick signed a mining deal in 1999 with RCD Goma, a Rwandan-backed rebel group fighting the Congolese government. According to Madsen, one of the main goals of RCD was, quote, restoration of mining concessions for Barrick Gold, unquote.
The DRC's richest mining area is in the southern province of Katanga. In October 2004, the Canadian-Australian company Anvil Mining provided logistical support to the DRC's army to suppress a rebellion in the town of Kilwa, where Anvil operates a copper-silver mine. The company gave the army a plane, vehicles, personnel, and food. The military used these supplies to massacre 70 to 100 civilians, even though the rebels offered no resistance.
Prince Kumwamba is executive director of the Congolese human rights organization Action Against Impunity for Human Rights, ACID in French. ACID is based in Lubumbashi, capital of Katanga province. The organization has been trying to bring those responsible for the Kilwa massacre to justice and to obtain compensation for the victims in the Congo and abroad.
Je crois que notre organisation avait mené des enquêtes.
I think that our organization investigated this massacre in 2004.
militaires des forces armées congolaises, de la RDC évidemment,
Through this investigation, we realized that the soldiers of the Congolese army had committed killings of people considered to be sympathetic to the insurrectional movement that had happened in Kilwa. In reaction, the armed forces of the DRC, invited by the corporation Anvil Mining, and with its material support, including trucks and also a plane to transport some soldiers, had committed these killings, as well as looting and burning down some homes of the population in Kilwa. So for us, the Anvil Mining Corporation was very implicated, but unfortunately, the Congolese justice system couldn't make that finding. The massacres were committed in October 2004, and in January 2005, our organization was informed about these massacres. We sent a letter to Anvil Mining to ask Anvil to tell us to what point it was involved in these massacres. Unfortunately, the corporation never answered our letter.
Dans la commission de ces massacres. Malheureusement, l'entreprise n'avait jamais répondu à notre lettre. Alors, nous avons nous-mêmes.
So in April, after our letter in January, we issued a press release to denounce the massacre and to denounce especially the silence of the corporation that didn't want to clarify for the population its possible involvement.
Ces massacres et de dénoncer surtout le silence de l'entreprise qui ne voulait pas éclaircir la population sur son implication éventuelle dans ces massacres.
So in April, an Australian TV channel visited us in Lubumbashi, and we drove them to Kilwa ourselves to prove everything that we were alleging about these massacres. And some weeks later, this TV channel produced a movie that described the situation. It infuriated Bill Turner, CEO of Anvil Mining, and he began to take action on an international level, and especially on a local level, here with the local authorities, to try to prevent us from talking about this story.
Partly due to ASCID's demands, Congolese military personnel and Anvil Mining employees were tried for the Kilwa massacre by a military court in 2007. The court acquitted military officers and three expatriate employees of Anvil Mining of charges of war crimes and complicity in war crimes. The expatriates were Canadian Pierre Mercier, general manager of Anvil Mining Congo, and two South Africans. According to Amnesty International, quote, there was apparent high-level political interference in the trial, as well as intimidation of witnesses. The acquittals were widely condemned as a setback in the struggle against impunity in the DRC. End quote.
La société Anvil Mining s'est sérieusement impliquée avec l'aide des autorités congolaises pour empêcher que
Anvil Mining Corporation seriously involved itself with the support of the Congolese authorities to prevent a fully independent trial. As a result, the judgment that was issued was a false judgment. A judgment that has no relation to the acts committed in Kilwa. A judgment that said there was no massacre.
Alors que plusieurs rapports, y compris les rapports des Nations Unies de la mission des Nations Unies au Congo,
whereas several reports, including the reports of the United Nations mission in Congo, have demonstrated that tens of people were massacred, that lootings were committed, and that rapes were committed by soldiers of Colonel Adamar Ilunga. So for us, it's a complacent verdict, issued in order to exempt the true criminals from their legal responsibilities.
In April 2008, Prince Kumwamba tried to visit Kilwa on behalf of an Australian legal firm pursuing possible compensation claims in the Australian courts against Anvil Mining. The Congolese government barred Kumwamba from going to Kilwa, and after that, he started getting threats on the phone, warning him to stop his activities concerning the Kilwa massacre and Anvil Mining. Amnesty International issued an urgent action on Kumwamba's behalf in April 2008 and believes that the government may be behind the threats and that his life may be in danger.
We asked Prince Kumwamba what he would like Canadians to do.
We simply ask them to exert some pressure on these Canadian multinational corporations, to encourage them to have some morality, to have a bit of generosity, to participate in the development of the native population, to dedicate a fraction of the benefits. Rather than collaborating and hurting them, notably through acts such as anvil mining committed against the population of Kilwa. And I think at this moment, they can support us.
We go now to Guatemala, where 80% of the population is indigenous Maya, and Canadian mining companies are the new conquistadors. Goldcorp, Canada's second largest gold mining company, operates the open-pit Marlin gold mine in the department of San Marcos. The mine traverses the municipalities of San Miguel Ixtahuacán and Sipacapa. The Marlin mine has brought official repression, deforestation, contamination of water sources, dry wells, dangerous wastes, and damage to houses. There is so much public opposition to the mine that 98% of area residents voted against it in a referendum. Goldcorp ignored the vote.
Fausto Valiente works with the Pastoral Commission on Peace and Ecology, COPAI, which is linked to the Diocese of San Marcos, that is part of the Catholic Church. Valiente came to Toronto to protest at Goldcorp's annual general meeting in May 2008. He attended the meeting where he spoke. We asked him what happened there.
At the beginning, they gave this presentation, which painted a very nice picture of mining, making it seem as if this was a great development opportunity.
Para la minería, es decir, ellos lo ponen como una gran actividad de desarrollo.
However, we all know that this is not the case, given the environmental, social, and economic negative consequences we have witnessed and experienced. They also never addressed the questions and comments we made.
Resistance to the mine has been answered by repression, including murders, arrests, threats, and intimidation.
We do know that the government acts in favor of mining companies, and that they have in the past used repression against the communities that oppose them.
Asesinando algunas personas. El año pasado en San Miguel Ixtahuacán apareció una persona decapitada.
For example, last year in San Miguel Ixtahuacán, a man who opposed mining and refused to sell his land to this company was found dead and beheaded.
No quería vender sus tierras.
In January 2005, the government sent in 200 soldiers and police to suppress a public demonstration against the mine. Two people were killed by security forces and 26 were injured.
The newspaper only reported one death, but there were two, and many others were wounded at the hands of 200 soldiers and police employed by the government. The government and the authorities also used threats to repress and intimidate people.
Those whose lives have been threatened due to the mine include the Bishop of San Marcos.
Just a month ago, Monsignor Ramazzini received a death threat, ordering him to stop getting involved in this type of conflict.
Members of COPAI have also been intimidated, and Valiente is concerned for his own safety.
A nosotros, por ejemplo, nos han perseguido.
In our case, we have been followed when we are in the countryside doing our work. For example, when I do my environmental monitoring work, my team has been followed, photographed, and filmed in a manner that is quite threatening and intimidating.
Yo al momento no he recibido amenazas, solo estas persecuciones que te...
I have yet to receive any threats, but I am not sure what will happen upon my return to Guatemala following the speaking tour.
Regresar a Guatemala tengo como un poco de temor por lo que pueda suceder al volver.
In spite of the repression, Valiente and the community are determined to resist the Goldcorp mine.
The work we are currently doing is mostly focused on the communities Marlin wishes to explore, which are located within the eight remaining municipalities of San Marcos, where mining potential has been assessed. To counter this, we are coordinating and carrying out community consultations to address the issue. The objective is that once the consultations have been completed, communities reach a consensus in their opposition, which can then be used to close the doors to this company and halt the further expansion of their mining prospects. We do know that in Tajamulco, one of the communities that has yet to go through its consultation, the people there have vowed that they will burn any company machinery or lynch employees that enter their lands without their permission.
Official repression and Canadian mining go hand in hand in Guatemala. The country suffered from a 36-year civil war that lasted until 1996 when peace accords were signed. During the war, the U.S.-backed Guatemalan army killed close to 250,000 civilians, wiping out 400 indigenous Mayan villages. The Canadian mining company Inco operated in Guatemala during the war, and relations between the genocidal military and Inco were so close that the army tortured people inside Inco facilities.
Edgar Godoy is a Guatemalan-Canadian labor leader of mixed Mayan and Spanish ethnicity. He is president of Local 2191 of the Canadian Union of Public Employees in Toronto and an activist in international solidarity. Godoy did his master's thesis on the impact of Canadian mining companies on Guatemala, focusing on Inco and Goldcorp.
As a historical context, I look at what Inco did in Guatemala in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. The mining companies in Guatemala, international mining companies, are all Canadians. Mining at a large scale began with Inco in the 1960s. With the started operation there during the military rules in Guatemala, and they acquire large extensions of land that's in the Department of Izabal. They were exploiting nickel there. But also, they were, during the peace signing of peace agreements in Guatemala, there were two commissions. One was the commission for historical the memory, and the other one's the United Nations Commission. And both commissions have a case there in which it was found that the company Inco was in cooperation with the army during the violation of human rights of those times. They used the company facilities to torture people. Inco was in bed with the military, with the junta, during those years.
Inco has also been implicated in the Guatemalan army's murder of the lawyer attempting to unionize workers at its Izabal mine.
Mijangos Lopez was killed around 73, and he was organized, the main lawyer helping organizing the union. That's how Inco at once kill the legal representative and stop the process of unionization of the workers in the plant in Izabal. The army did the actual killing, but Inco was complicit in it because they were paying the army to not only provide security for the plant, but also to persecute all those involved in organizing the union within the plant.
The same army that killed close to 250,000 Guatemalans and tortured thousands more is now guarding Goldcorp's Marlin mine.
The people fear that army, given the past, you know, practices in kidnapping, torturing, and violating people's human rights, in particular the indigenous communities. It brings back memories. We're back to the same square number one, in a sense, because of this, the greed of these corporations, because the community will not be benefiting in any shape or form.
Canadian mining companies are fueling not only conventional war, but also nuclear war, the ultimate horrifying conflict that could end all humanity. Canada accounts for up to 40% of the world's uranium production, making it the largest producer of this essential mineral in nuclear weapons. Cameco, based in Saskatchewan, is the largest uranium mining company in the world. Canada is the main source of uranium for the U.S. nuclear arsenal, the world's largest at 10,000 warheads. The U.S. is an aggressive, threatening nuclear power with a first-strike policy. It is the only country that has actually used atomic bombs and is today actively preparing for nuclear war. Uranium from Canadian mines was used in the two nuclear bombs dropped by the US on Japan in 1945. Canada has not only provided uranium, but also some of the research that led to the dawn of the nuclear age. This was done at McGill University in Montreal.
Uranium mining in Canada fuels nuclear and conventional war, as depleted uranium, or DU, from Canada is used in nuclear and conventional weapons. Canada is the biggest supplier of DU to the United States. DU makes conventional shells far more deadly and spreads lethal radiation. DU's effects have been particularly devastating during the criminal U.S. war on Iraq, leading to babies born without heads and spiraling cancer rates.
Professor Jim Harding taught at the University of Regina in Saskatchewan. He is author of the recent book, Canada's Deadly Secret, Saskatchewan Uranium and the Global Nuclear System.
We're right smack in the middle of the British-American, arms system. And we can't seem to get it through our consciousness that we are not just used by the American, Anglo-American sort of imperial systems. We were willing compatriots in this creation of nuclear weapons. We were involved at the very front end of the Manhattan project that created the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The uranium that was used for the uranium bomb used at Hiroshima was refined at Port Hope. And I think that the two sources were probably some from the Belgian Congo and some from the Port Radium mine that was reopened. The early work with the CANDU reactor in Montreal at McGill and then at Chalk River also played a role with the production of the plutonium for the plutonium bomb, which was used in Nagasaki. And the UK's weapons program was based on the research at McGill and the prototype reactor that ended up as the CANDU.
In 1970, the Canadian government signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The government guaranteed that Canadian uranium would not be used for weapons production, only for nuclear reactors generating electricity. However, according to Professor Harding, the government did not tell the truth. From 1970 till now, Canada has been providing uranium for use in U.S. nuclear and conventional bombs in violation of the treaty.
The weapons connection, in a sense, got obscured when the Non-Proliferation Treaty came because technically the uranium is shipped to the U.S. or to France for their reactors, but in fact the depleted uranium that's left is then in the control of those countries. While it's true that that process is to go into the electrical generating nuclear reactors, about 9/10 of the mass of what's left after enriching, which is called depleted uranium, is then available to the Department of Defense to use for weapons. And then, of course, the various weapons-producing companies, Aerojet and some of the others, take it and make the depleted uranium weapons that are now clearly contaminating, probably the last four war zones in the Middle East and Southern Europe. And the public is, I think, largely unaware that we're still complicit in directly in the weapons stream, even though it's a kind of a tricky thing to track. So it fundamentally abrogates the intentions of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but not technically. It's not technically breaching it.
Depleted uranium is also packed into the nuclear hydrogen bomb, giving it its enormous destructive power.
It's frightening stuff to think about. We're talking madness here in terms of the capacities. How few of these mega bombs it would take to create a catastrophe that, probably makes climate change look a little insignificant.
The opposition of Native Canadians to uranium mining on their land has been met by official repression. In March 2008, Bob Lovelace, former chief of the Arduk Algonquin First Nation, was sentenced to 6 months in jail and fined $25,000 for trying to stop uranium mining by the Canadian company Frontenac Ventures on Algonquin land in Ontario. Paula Sherman, the nation's chief, was fined $15,000. Lovelace was freed after serving 3 months, but only due to considerable public protest. With his release, the two fines were dropped. In this way, uranium mining in Canada fuels both wars and domestic repression. Bob Lovelace.
The governments, if they don't take the responsibility, then we're forced to take a course of resistance. And we don't want a course of resistance. We want a course of cooperation and complement. That's our traditional way, is to find a higher solution. No, you can't repress people and expect them to join as partners. If you want people to join as partners in a confederation, you recognize their original jurisdiction. You recognize the values of their culture, and that's what needs to happen with Aboriginal people.
Chief Paula Sherman is a single mother of two daughters. She was threatened with imprisonment if she tried to block uranium mining on Algonquin land. If jailed, she could have lost custody of her children.
This is definitely a symbol of colonialism and repression at the hands of the Ontario government.
According to Chief Paula Sherman, the Ontario government has used mining to wipe out the native economy and culture.
And it's also the case, you just have to go back historically and even look at the Ministry of Natural Resources. That ministry was started as the Crown Lands Department to actually enforce assimilation. You know, so on the one hand, you know, after Confederation and the development of the Indian Act, they had the Indian Act assimilating Aboriginal peoples through that assimilation policy to not practice traditional harvesting and trapping and all those kinds of things. And then any communities, individuals who wanted to still do that could be charged under the MNR. So they were using the Ministry of Natural Resources to charge people who refused to abide by the assimilation tactics, you know. So mining and northern development is just another mechanism in that kind of control, right? So it's actually repression, for sure.
Colonialism continues today in Canada. There's no doubt about that, that most of the laws that were set down with colonial foundations. What legislators have to do today is they have to be honest about that, and they have to ask themselves, do they want to live in the past or do they want to live in the future? The future in this country means that colonialism has to come to an end. No government that supports colonialism today is fit to govern. Things have to change.
You have been listening to Fueling Wars and Repression, the second episode of the documentary series Path of Destruction, Canadian Mining Companies Around the World.
Path of Destruction, Canadian Mining Companies Around the World is dedicated to Indigenous peoples everywhere.
This documentary was written by Asad Ismi and produced by Kristen Schwartz. Go to www.asadismi.ws. That's www.asadismi.ws to download the series.
Translation by Alex Petrov, Susie Alvarez, William Satcher, and Sandra Cuff. Voiceover by Matthew Fava and Susie Alvarez.
Theme music is Shaman's Call and Come Home Safe Dance Mix by TKO from Winnipeg, Canada.
Many thanks to Danae Paird and Kevin Shaw of CHRY 105.5 FM in Toronto.
This documentary was funded by the Canadian Union of Postal Workers National,
CUPW Local 576 North Bay,
Canadian Union of Public Employees Local 3903,
QP National,
Ontario Public Service Employees Union,
Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation,
Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association,
Public Service Alliance of Canada,
Ken Lucart,
and the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives.
Thank you for listening.